These are poems, according to the tree out there, Plum Creek Odyssey, and they will be primarily from this book. But I usually throw in a few extras here and there from other poems, some not published in here. I'm going to have to, even before I begin, apologize for a scratchy throat and for a nose just starting to drip. So if I really run out of gas even sooner than normally, then just hope you'll overlook that. I still want to read. It's just the voice may fail me. Spirit is willing. Let's start with a poem called I-80, which is not in the book. And it should have been. There are a couple of poems that should have been in there that aren't. I-80 refers to Interstate 80. And that's the one we were on so many times, going from Southern California to Nebraska. Anybody from Nebraska is in here? I always...
No, but Iowa.
Iowa. Close.
Very close.
You bet. I-80 runs right through there, too. That's all the way to New York, I think, doesn't it? I think it goes coast to coast. Pretty much. Anyway, we made several trips on I-80 to Lincoln, where I was doing graduate work. And there was a little one off-ramp near Seward off-ramp, about 25 miles from Lincoln. And I used to go down there once in a while and just sit and watch cars go by. Finally got so bad in Seward that you had to do something. I didn't believe this at first when we went back there, that they would want to do things like one of the friends in the art department. He said, "Well, let's go down and look at the wrecks brought in off the interstate." And I said, "Well, gee, I could do without that, Bill. That doesn't sound like first-class entertainment." And I was there about a month, and I find myself walking down to this graveled parking lot behind the theater where the wrecks would be brought in from the interstate, and just people would stand and look at those wrecks and say, "Boy, bet they didn't make that one, and look at that." And it was kind of a grisly pastime, but there wasn't a whole bunch of other things to do. You could walk uptown to the courthouse and count the pigeons on the statue, and which we did. We did that almost daily. And anyway, this off-ramp had a... Got some real competition up there tonight for the little guys. This off-ramp had an Indian site, Indian plaque. There's some Oto Indians had lived there. And you all know the site. Any kind of rest stop is, they're all alike. And there was really nothing magic about it. But for some reason, it attracted me. It seemed to attract a lot of people just to stop there and watch the trucks boil over, and kids fight, and the dogs run amok. Always be a sign, keep your dog on leash, and the dogs always take off, hiking their legs on everything in sight, and back into the cars, and stuff the kids in, and off you go again. I-80 runs along the Blue River, and the hot station wagons boil over beneath the diseased elms that bear the red X. "Next year we're promised Pin Oaks," croons the elderly lady, passing out brochures. The river is green from the trees, green and thick, slow-moving between the muddy banks. The plaque reads, "Prehistoric Indian site." "God, all they got in Nebraska is dead Indians," says a man in shorts with black dress shoes and long black socks. "Skeeters," slap, whack, with the brochure on rednecks. "Hell, let them keep the place." And off on I-80, heading east to education or west to retirement, leaving the blue sluggish in its banks and the Oto bones quiet beneath the green hillock. Those of you from the Midwest know that what I'm talking about, the diseased elms, right?
Yeah.
Dutch elm disease wiping out the entire Midwest. And when they get really bad, they'd come out and put a big red X, and then the next Saturday, here come the big machine to gobble up the... I remember very vividly one day sitting on the front porch watching a squirrel that would always come past our house and jump from the wire onto a tree, and then down the tree to the street and across to the college. And they had just, a couple hours before, the machine had come down and just, the tree, it was leveled to the ground. and the squirrel was making his rounds. And he came hoppity-hipping down, and he kind of started to leap, like the kids did in the skit last night, going to leap off the bridge. And he just kind of grabbed himself by his tail. And he looked around. He couldn't believe, like, where's his tree? And he retreated a few steps, and then he came back again. And then he just kept on going down the block, and I never saw him again. He said, well, if that's the way you're going to treat me, I'll go find another tree. It's too bad. They're losing all those beautiful trees. I was at St. Paul about 3 weeks ago. I guess they're doing the same thing back there.
Is it happening anywhere else in the country?
Well, I don't know. Anybody wants to speak to that? I've only seen it happen in... Pardon?
Portland, Oregon.
Portland, Oregon. Yeah. Is that right?
Huh.
Sure has. Well, I guess it's gonna stop with Portland, then. It's not gonna go anywhere else. Well, Seward, Nebraska is a nice little town. And it's like all small towns in some respects. And interestingly enough, it's like big towns in some other respects. You can be just as lonely or just as busy in any place, I found, after having lived in a Seward where it was 5,000 and having grown up in Los Angeles where it was 15 million in the county, another 4 million in the city, and the outlying suburbs, another couple million, so you had over 20 million people. And I didn't find it difficult to be alone at all in Los Angeles. But then there were times when you're very lonely with 20 million people, and I found the same was true of the small towns. I was born on a farm in southern Illinois and grew up alone pretty much. For entertainment, when I was a kid, I used to pick up little pigs. And I remember my father thought I was crazy and really worried. And I would take these little pig under each arm out in the fields and lie down with the little pigs and I'd sing. I'd make up songs by the hour. And my mother would call me, she couldn't find me, she'd go out there, I was with my little pigs. The pigs squealing and struggling. I thought they were dying to hear me sing to them. I thought everybody grew up that way. I kind of miss that. So. Yeah, and it was, as a matter of fact, looking back, I'm sure it was, because I was just kind of creating my own world. Here's a poem called Warm Benches. It's around the square of the courthouse, where all the old folks would sit on these benches, and some would play checkers, and some would just sit pretty much the way I do up here under the bell, pick out a place in the sun and sit there from breakfast to lunch, and then from lunch to supper. Warm benches. The old men at odds and at peace with the world stare the day down. The russet hills falling asleep under the big hot sun ask nothing of these men. The crowd of puffer pigeons scratch beneath the green benches, hardly moving a wing in their rounds. There's no danger. Four sides. The square is four sides. All the world is what they think of all day. The sides seem immense, the traffic abstract. The talking sidewalks lean in on them. The people threaten them with their walking, their breathing, their knowing and saying of things, and their living. When the grain truck stops, they lean on their sticks and laugh, and later cry at the goodness of the driver, his stops, his cattle, his world. The park is small. The courthouse, hard gray stone and shade, and Brockoff's drugstore closes. The eyes see the sign turn in the window, see the bricks turn blue in the shade, and two pigeons light on the statue's rifle, scratching beneath their wings, the heads turning full round. The wind kicks the dust under the benches, the empty ones. And the night calls them home for how-dos to the summer people to Rolf's Myers for ice cream, and the tilted rocker, some sleep awakened by choking in the dreams, and gripped comforts and quilts, and tomorrow, and the warm benches, and the benches. Uh, I read from some of these poems last week, and as I think I pointed out then, almost any poet gets paranoid about repeating poems. Is there anybody here that was here last week and maybe heard these? Oh, good. And I can read them, huh?
Right.
Fine.
I was, but I'll carry them.
All right. That's an honest answer. I don't know if that makes any sense to anybody about that, but it's almost all writers are that way. You just kind of have a fear of doing it, for even though people very often love to hear the same poems over and over if they like them, but still it's kind of frightening. It's like going into a closet and not being able to put on anything. You don't know what clothes to wear. You say, well, I can't wear this one. And you kind of, well, no, that won't do. And, well, I can't wear that, obviously. You stand there a half hour wondering you got 20,000 things to put on. You say, none of this will do. The same with poems. You say, well, I can't read this poem. And you're sitting out there, why can't you read it? Just read the bloody thing. Talk about it. So I'm going to read it. It's a trilogy called The Auction, The Home, and The Death. And they're about auctions, and the illustrations are really neat in this particular page, because it shows all the tools and behind the house, and crocks and stuff stacked up on the sides, and people rummaging around, picking up things. And in the front, you have highboys and dressers and sofas and some rocking chairs. Very festive occasion. Those of you who've been at auctions, you'll know how that goes. There's one thing in Los Angeles that we don't have at auctions. It's going to be an auction. It's going to be held at the Biltmore. It cost you $1 million. And that's not worth any auction at Seward, Nebraska. We can go free and drink beer and lemonade and eat fish and buy something for 2 bits that look great in your entryway. Auction. He started at the rear of the house with the tools while the ladies gathered near the front porch to sift through the personal things. All around the house, the furniture had been arranged. And after seeing the naked, shamed inside, which they had sat in for years, the older women found rockers in the front to sit in, and they rocked easily. The men showed up for the tools. Standing close to the wooden benches and tables, they looked a convention of train men in their striped coveralls and train caps. The coveralls gaped at the side, showing blue denim shirts or long underwear. Their burnt red faces screwed up into funny looks as the auctioneer approached. His one stump arm carried the black glove at a hammer angle. The men joked and looked away. They had already felt the length of the sledges or tested the bite and grip of saws and pliers, sideways glancing them with nods, wanting the saw for 2 bits. Joking at the running words that spilled like an organized waterfall behind the frame house, the others waited with foot raised on bumpers of shining new pickups, watching but not bidding. They come at auctions. Who's moving? What's he selling? Well, that's all right, though I got one already. As the seller of things moves around the house, the men trail off, pushing the mowers, hefting guiltily the long wrenches. Then the long line of canned goods and brown crocks, pickles watched by sharp-nosed women. And the late ones stand against the high boy stacked in front. The rocking women rock and don't complain that they can't see. The muscled man in front is buying glassware. He doesn't nod for it, but he buys the glass for his shop on the Milford Road. When the letters and scissors and beads and buttons are gone in the one box and the round German pictures for frames, the rockers go, and the old women go home to bake and to wait. Then the small boys jump through the flower beds at tag, and the station wagon lumbers over the ditch with a bed spring sticking out, and the tally sheet is figured inside on a card table that didn't sell. The throat is going fast. Like a shot of bourbon and branch water, as Faulkner would say, would probably do a world of good. Probably just knock me right out on top of the other stuff. But after the stuff is gone, then the house goes. And I always like to tell this story because I can't get away from the story because it's so vividly impressed in my mind. That one summer we were back there, we went to an auction in a little town called Friend, Nebraska, which is a friendly little name. It was about 20 miles from Lincoln. And went to the auction. It was a three-story frame house on 5 acres of land with a big red barn and a couple of small barns, a little brook running through it and a little orchard and things. And the whole house had been newly floored, hardwood floors and new plumbing and white paint. Beautiful 5 acres, a lot of trees. It sold for $11,500 at auction.
Oh.
And that's what I said. I just wanted to camp right there. I said, that's it. Stay here in Friend, Nebraska. And I would have had to grub around for roots and herbs, though, because there's nothing else to do out there. Interestingly enough, the fellow who bought it was a rural mailman, and born and raised in Oxnard, California, which is 6 miles from where I live. And we meet in Friend, Nebraska.
Mm-hmm.
Well, after everything's gone, the house is gone, then the next poem is the home, because this is what happens oftentimes to the old folks who have to go somewhere. The hot morning sun sucked the shadow off the wide board porch where the old woman rocked. The bustle in the house was noisier than necessary, but she rocked the same for all of the talk that hung heavy on the August air. From her porch, she could see the ladies gather across the graveled street, their heads bonneted and bent in the trellis shade. Her long bony hands tightened on the smooth brown rocker arms. She shuffled her feet on the porch and lifted a yellowed handkerchief to her throat, then let it drop to her lap. The sun spun in a mazy light, white motions in the beams that struck the hot roof of the pickup that bumped the ditch and rolled to a stop at the porch. The driver smiled a wide, clean smile and said, "Ma'am," as he leaped the steps and banged through the screen door. The old lady tried to say something as he jumped the steps, but he moved too fast in the sun, his face blurred in the web of years that held her in her chair. The ladies in the shade looked up as the family started out the door, formal, like an odd parade. They marked the ties, the old blue suit, the fans, the brooch, and how they passed the chair but turned in awkward angles to look before they got in cars. The old woman rocked and rubbed one hand upon the other and felt she ought to tell them of her dresses that they folded in the truck. And the ladies on the swing cried, "Hush, and come out and see now," to others in the house across the street. The sun came up the steps. The chair rocked, but slower. And turning once, she saw the neighbor's cat lying quiet in the gladiolas, watching the soft brown birds dancing in the bird bath. And she kept looking at the cat and the birds as she was lifted from the chair, her back held firm by long, strong arms, her head against his chest, the world moving around her as she watched. And all the world there was sat quiet across the street, as the trellis vine stirred slightly in the darkness of the porch. Those two, by the way, if you want to say anything or ask anything as I go, feel free to do that, okay? There's nothing sacred about a poetry reading. Just relax. And if you want to say, ask a question, by all means do so. Those two poems came at the same time. I remember vividly coming at the same moment, I think within an hour or 2 hours, they were both out. And then 10 years passed before I wrote the third part of the trilogy called The Death. I don't know exactly what that says. It says something about the psyche knowing when it's time to do things, and it sends up poems, and sometimes it doesn't do any good to try to rush it. Well, it never does any good to try to rush it. And of course, I don't tell my students that in creative writing. I rush them. And, but secretly, I tell them to write 6 poems a week, and they say, "Yes, but I'm not inspired." I say, "Well, I'm your inspiration. Just do it." They say, "Do you write that way?" I'm not going to hang my head and say, "Well, no. But this is my class." I got the marbles. I make them do that, but because I've learned through experience that if you just sit around waiting to be inspired, you'll probably have a long gray beard before you do anything. And after 14 or 18 weeks of 6 poems a week, you're going to have 80 to 90 poems in a manuscript that you would not have if you waited around. After they get out of my class, they can do it their way, but that's the best way to get them going. And out of 80 or 90 poems, you're going to have some pretty good ones. Anyway, the third and last part of the set is called The Death. She tried. They had fixed her up a room like that she'd left. They gave her sun in afternoons and allowed the fern brought by a cousin. The canary, a gift from the sun, did not live long, but still she tried. The few pictures in her album were rounded at the edges from handling. She combed her long gray hair, brushed it, set the favorite comb, and went to bed. And the first long winter passed without a mark or sign to show she'd ever been anywhere but there. Then the spring, and the hot summer. And when the trees turned yellow in the wood, she closed the door and sat on the creaking bed. She didn't cry or move at all, nor ask for dinner when they came at 5, but only passed one hand across her hair to make it neat for anyone who came. No one did. An early snow covered nearly all the ground the day they buried her. The sun stood by as forms were offered, signed, witnessed. And then they started out and left the home she had never known, past trees bare and white, past people moving slowly on the icy streets, and children's eyes looking up. Those are very somber poems. But sometimes the auctions get kind of somber. You realize what's happening to the people after the auctions, after all the goodies are gone. But they're not always. Most of the time, they're pretty happy things.
Oh, garage sales.
Yeah, garage sales. Right, that's right. That's our answer to the auctions. Those could be fun. A friend of mine goes to every Saturday morning. Calls it garage sailing. I'm going garage sailing. He goes a whole bloody day garage sailing. Or then he goes to a gigantic swap meet.
Do what? He goes and buys things?
Swap meet. I don't know if he does that or not. I think he just buys. I've never known him to. Maybe trades, yeah. Drive-in theaters on Sunday mornings, they open them up and half the stuff is new and stolen, of course. You go there and see racks on racks of Levi's, and I don't know how that can be swap stuff, you know, and they're not. And sometimes there are more plainclothesmen walking in there than there are the rest of us. Nabbing people with great big color, 16 color TVs and things like that. Here's a poem called A Girl. I wrote this for my mother. There was quite a while when she had some problems understanding or wondering why I wrote poems, why I didn't do something else, something more manly, I guess, or be a lawyer or something. And I said, well, I just like to write. I mean, I'm a teacher too, you know. But she always overlooked that and said, well, what about this writing stuff? And then she'd find a poem in a magazine, and she'd always, when we come to dinner on Sunday, she'd say, what does that mean? I said, well, it just means what it says. She said, what are you saying? What are you trying to say? What's on your mind? Then she'd stop. She said, why are you doing this? I've disgraced the family. It's like being an actor back in the 19th century. You know, my daughter's an actress. Terrible. So I wrote her this poem, and in great big caps, I made sure the editor knew, for my mother, in parentheses. Well, an interesting story connected to that, because my mother and father are staunch Republicans, and I am not quite of that persuasion. And they have a color TV they finally got. It's kind of the shrine in their trailer. And when Spiro Agnew had fallen on hard times, my mother and father were outraged, figuring it was a comedy plot and the whole thing was set up. And Nixon was out after him, or somebody was. And so I said, listen, if you feel so strongly, why don't you write the guy and tell him? I was joking. She said, I will. I said, well, good. She said, where does he live? I said, I don't know where Spiro Agnew lives. He spends some time with Frank Sinatra in Palm Springs. She said, good, I'll write him there. I said, good, Mom, do that. So she got an envelope. She started writing out, Spiro Agnew, care of Frank Sinatra, Palm Springs, California. I said, is that it? She says, Palm Springs. She mailed it. I said, oh, good. Well, I was down there about a month later, and she was just grinning like a Cheshire cat. She wanted me to see something, and over here she had a little letter from Spiro Agnew. Dear Millie, thanks for your support. You're right, I was innocent. Your pal, Spiro Agnew. With a big color TV on this side, and a letter here. And I was dumbfounded. But then, to really put the icing on the cake, she had taken my poem and had some neighbor do some kind of decoupage thing on a little open book, and with my poem and little rosettes and Tweety Birds all around the edge. And that was in the middle. So I had the color TV, Agnew's letter, and my poem, this ugly, gauche open book with Tweety Birds. And she was very pleased then, see, because I was in. Not only that, but a week later, and this I couldn't hardly believe, but I saw it with my own eyes. They got an album through the mail. Frank Sinatra's album, Old Blue Eyes is back, and written across, thanks for supporting my pal, Frank Sinatra.
No. Oh.
And when she showed me that, I almost turned Republican. But not quite. But she was very pleased with herself. So anyway, that's kind of the background of this poem. It's called A Girl, but it can be for all girls. A girl belongs to the earth, whether young or old. In spring or fall, she belongs to the earth. She is the earth, growing things, spice and potatoes, green pulsing life that bends like a rainbow to cover the brown hills with soft, moist rain. And in the silence of a quiet study of sewing by the firelight, she sings a melody too deep for ears to hear or voice to sing, yet is sure of the sound and knows the worth of the song. And bruised knees on flowered hills gives way to ribboned hair and downward glances, perfumed fingers that reach through time to find their way, sure of the sound, knowing the worth of the song. And lace beside the pungent leather and wood with smiles, laughing, racing now and happiest, then quiet, soft the touch, as the mirrored face reflects the girl-like eyes of this her own to bake for, sew, love, comfort, and watch grow. While seasons glide with gray streamers of clouds running through the golden matzo color near the sun, and the peaceful shade of oak or elder brush the restful hours, and cool water drunk deeply from dark wells, close to earth, to no earth, and the blooming wisteria curling tendrils toward the sun to touch the wind and God, sure of the sound, knowing the worth of the song. So she liked that one, all right. And she didn't ask me what it means. Yeah, and I wouldn't have been able to tell her, of course. There's no way to say what those things mean. Do you have any cool questions or anything you can interrupt at any time? That'll help my throat get back in shape. Maybe.
Jack, I think of hearing them. Last year, then you talk about reading them more, but you hear something different each time.
Oh.
That you missed the time before.
That's nice. That's good. That happens to me once, very rarely that anybody ever reads my poems when I'm around to hear them read out loud. And coming up to Holden, we stopped at Harry and Gladys Flesher's house. They're here working for a while. They live in Portland. And Harry read that trilogy. And it was a revelation to hear. I realized he pronounced or emphasized adjectives, and I emphasize nouns more. And even that is a tremendous difference. This is the Salt Lick at Daybreak, Holden Village, 1974, the Salt Lick behind Chalet 1, where the deer still come to lick, and the birds still drop down to peck around. I was fascinated by that. The first year we were here, we were in Chalet 1. I woke up early one morning and looked out, four or five deer out there at the Salt Lick. And I kind of envied them, because when I was a kid, I used to play, pretend I was a cow on the farm with my cousin. And we'd go out on all fours in the pasture and lick the salt. And my aunt would get mad and come after us with a switch. And then we would escape and dive into the hog waller, which is exactly what it says. It's about a 2-foot deep mud thing. The hogs get in to cool off. And it's full of mud. And we'd just skinny dip in there and just pretend we were hogs. And my aunt couldn't follow us, so she'd kind of rant and rave, jump up and down and tell us all the things she was going to do. And so we never went out. We'd say this, she went away, and then we'd come out and go lick salt again. We had a great time. Yeah, back and forth. So this is Salt Lick at Daybreak, Holden. The salt block stands like a lamp. The long tongues reach out of the trees and caress the corners of the salt. The mountains move forward, press against the thing. The ground sucks through fern hills, fern hairs that move in blind, orgiastic circles, and low moans escape the shards of rock and limb that cannot come. The feast glides on tripod feet, clicking on stars, dropping bits of salt on the mucous leaves. And morning comes like sudden sparrows to peck and scratch, and the mountains pull back down their glacier gullies, the trees bend backwards toward cool deeps, and the long tongues slide after the deer who move in light from bark and stone. You have any requests? Or that's always a way to go.
Jack, what is the shards of rock?
Just bits and pieces, broken things. Yeah. there's something about that poem, the trilogy, and poems like that are narrative poems, and they communicate, I think, very simply and basically. And in that poem, I found something magic, or I imagined something mysterious about that, drawing the deer out of the dark forest and then disappearing back into the darkness of the forest. And so there's I don't know what's, some kind of symbols going on in that poem that it's altogether different from most of the stuff I write. It's a little thicker. I've always been fascinated by trees and woods. Anyway, let me give you another example. A poem called The Woods. And it's not in that collection. When we went to Nebraska and Seward, we lived close to the confluence of the Blue River and Plum Creek. And I used to go down and sit in this little creek, little narrow creek. It wasn't like Railroad Creek. It was muddy. It was only about 10 feet wide. It was hot in August, sweaty, and mosquitoes. That's like Copper Basin, like mosquitoes. And little patches of elm trees and thickets. And nobody else ever went there. I'm sure the people that lived near us wondered why I always went down there and sat and wondered what I was communing with down there. But whether I'm here in the big trees of the Cascades or little thickets, there's something about nature, whether it's the desert or the ocean or surfing or climbing. It's nature, it's the power, it's the presence there that fascinated me. It led to this poem called The Woods. Those branches there, did they move? Stand close a while. Soon or late, it might be there again. I'll prove to you these woods can hear. Shh, wait. There, it made the noise. I heard it move, some subtle shift of shade beneath the branch. You say a bird, I say something else, some sound nature made for us just because she wanted to. You needn't look at me. If you want a name, bird will do. I know what I saw and see. This is a poem I just opened to at random. Sometimes that's the best way to pick poems, to turn a page and read what's there. It's called Cemetery at Noon, Milford, Nebraska. Milford's another metropolis down the road from Seward, which is near Ong, and another town is Beaver Crossing, and another one is Ruby, and no one lives in Ruby. But this is, so I don't know why it's a town, but it is. And there's a little legend that goes before this poem. I was looking for a burial place of one of the Indians, one of the many passages of Indians going from Nebraska and Kansas down to the territories in Oklahoma to be put on reservations. And there's thousands and thousands of Indians made that trip, and many died. And I just read Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee, and was still angry, and I'm still angry when I even think about it. It's a tremendous book, but it's not a comfortable book. And one of the Indians was buried in this little cemetery in Milford, Nebraska. And this is right out of Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee. This is in quotes. Now it was the hot weather moon with showers falling almost every day. On June 6th, Prairie Flower died, and Standing Bear gave her a Christian burial in the cemetery at Milford, Nebraska. The ladies of Milford prepared and decorated the body for burial in a style becoming the highest civilization. A poem. Her bones are mingled with elm roots and wild chokeberries that race along the wooden fences. The sultry storms of summer rumble in the low hills as we pick our way between the markers, the wilted flowers tumble from bottles. Two old people kneel by a grave beneath a diseased elm bearing the red X. His pickup has Co-op B Nebraska on the side. The caretaker rakes along the fence and doesn't look up as we read names aloud, pointing, walking, watching the sky heavy with the coming storm, feeling the graves lean in on us, the dead sucking some silent sign from us, and we are blind and deaf, finding nothing in the tall grasses, building our markers as we go. I guess one of the things that struck me about that particular legend, that's a quote from Bury My Heart, is the part where it says, the ladies in Milford prepared and decorated the body for burial in a style becoming the highest civilization. That's just terribly ironic, the author, D. Brown, knowing the Indians, you know, and their way of burial, And then I can just imagine the good, well-meaning, but hopelessly ignorant ladies of Milford decorating her body as would befit a good Christian civilization. And her and the other Indian standing by, what the indignity they must have felt at that. I don't know exactly what that means. Both sides completely meaning the very best, and yet missing the entire boat. How about how about Sonnet for Dolores? She's not even here. I guess I can read that. She just got back from Martin's Ridge, and she's fell down two or three snowfields and is pooped. So I'll read the sonnet. Sonnet for Dolores. You whose eyes are clear as leaves, as bright, as mixed in color as the fall, a sense of movement on the limb, but silent, white against the trees at night, a moon immense and still, reflecting quiet on the pond. You whose eyes have told the path I take, the themes I make, the loneliness beyond, a mirroring of dreams I dream awake. You whose eyes, eternal and alone, go swiftly through the moments of your day, as water chucks against the smoothing stone beneath the bridge, a deepness run away. Must know the song, the sense, the untold ways which mirror in your eyes my quiet praise. I've got one poem. It's My Daughter Returns from a Disney Movie, which I read. Interestingly enough, several years ago I wrote religious poems. I did a series for the Lutheran Witness, which were with a classical art painting by Durer or Giotto or whoever, and then the artist did an iconography about the thing, and then I wrote the poem to go with it. It was one a month for 2 years. It was one of the most daring things that I think, especially the Missouri Synod, it was just unheard of. But in 2 years, the editor was sacked and went back to the parish, and now they have cheap newsprint and don't publish anything good, sour grapes. But anyway, while that two-year series was running, we were following the church year at times. Sometimes we would do prophets and people in the Old and New Testament. And then we did themes, and this one month was marriage. And the picture was Arno Fini's Wedding by Van Eyck. And, you know, it's a very startling picture. And so Bill Wolfram did the iconography for the picture, and then I wrote the poem, and I used this poem, Sonnet for Dolores. It was about a wedding. I thought, I'll use what I know best. Well, the editor sent me a letter, a Xerox copy of a letter about 3 months later from some person in Texas who was absolutely irate. How could the Lutheran Witness publish a sonnet about somebody named Dolores? What has that got to do with religion? Well, I didn't know what to say to such a person. I didn't know what's unreligious about it, first of all. My poor upbringing, but I never quite made the distinction between sacred and secular. I've always been more holistic and integrated than that. That things just are, and it's usually people who compartmentalize and say this is good and bad. This is religious, and obviously this can't be religious because I don't know Dolores. I don't know you, so it's not religious. And in a sense, the person was right. It's not religious for them. So I guess they had every right to write the letter. I don't understand it. Then I wrote another one for Lent. Bill chose the picture Christ on the Slab by somebody I've forgotten who. And Jesus is really dead. Just nothing but a loincloth and gray, ashen complexion. Really a sorrowful picture. So I wrote the poem, a very sorrowful poem. And there's no hope in the poem. None. I mean, he's dead. Because I knew next month was Easter and I was really going to let it rip. And I got another letter from Texas again. Different party. Saying, how could the Lutheran Witness print a poem where there's no hope? And Lent. And I went on and on, raking me over. As a poet, I should know better as a Lutheran. Didn't understand that one either. I always kind of thought that the whole point of Lent was dead, otherwise Easter is meaningless. I mean, you can't have it both ways. You can't pretend Christ died. You know, he either did and he rose or he didn't. So my poem, he was dead. And the next month, he was really alive. He came blasting out of that tomb. I didn't get any letters, though. Only if they didn't like it. Well, I don't know why I said all that. Here's one of the things, the only thing we took back with us in that year in Nebraska, and I spent my residence year, was television. Otherwise, we got everything from garage sales and auctions. I remember for $100, we completely filled the house with stuff, an old couch, the guts of which were always falling out. Dolores had to tack it up, turn it over and tack it up, stuff in kittens and dogs and papers. And the windows had old sheets across it, and nobody I knew I was there. Typical Seward fashion. In a way, it was a little disheartening, because I had taught there from 64 to 66 for 2 years at the college. And then I went back every summer doing graduate work at Lincoln, because I'd started there. And I thought I'd just keep it a nice vacation rather than go to UCLA or SC, which were 5 miles from my house in Nebraska to finish. And so then in 72, 73, I had to do the whole year, write the dissertation and all that. And I was there and didn't see hardly anybody because I was very busy. But then when I was all through, about May, I wandered down to the square and I went to the Ben Franklin dime store. And there was a guy in the religious department named Charlie somebody. And Charlie says, "Well, Jack, how you been?" And I said, "Fine, Charlie." He said, "I haven't seen you around much." And I says, I started to say, "Well, I've been busy." He says, "Say, are you still on that committee that we were working on those problems?" And he started rattling off this. I said, "Charlie, that was 5, 6, 7 years ago." He stopped. He looked at me. He said, "Aren't you Jack Ledbetter?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "Don't you teach here?" I said, "I did 7 years ago." He said, "Well, what are you doing here now?" I said, "Well, I've just been here writing and working on stuff." He said, "Oh." He went off mumbling to himself, scratching his head. 2 or 3 people had that same effect. Must be small town syndrome or something. Once you're there, you're never completely gone, but they're never sure you're there all the time. He just assumed he'd seen me last week, and now in Ben Franklin, it was seeing me again. How you been? Good old Charlie. I love that. You can't do that in Los Angeles. Anyway, we had the one TV, and I was watching it. Took a day off, and I was watching the Lakers play the Chicago Bulls. And I've always been a big fan of Jerry West. And my daughter had just come home. Becky had come back from the theater, the Rivoli, only one theater in town, very narrow. There. I remember we watched The Shoes of the Fisherman. We're the only couple in the entire theater. And our postman was the guy who ran the projector. He and his wife, he took the tickets, his wife sold popcorn. And he had old-fashioned projectors, because I hear a little bell go off, and I hear it go boom, 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 boom up the stairs, open the thing, change the reel, slam it, and boom, 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 down it, and it did, and about an hour later, bing, and up you go again. And we were the only ones there, and they showed it anyway. Well, anyway, she had just come back from seeing a Disney movie, and she wanted to tell me about it, and I was not interested. I wasn't listening to her. I was trying to watch the game. But I was conscious of her wanting me to listen, so it led to a poem later. Chicago Bulls have just whipped my Lakers, and the bile is still up as she bangs open the back door and runs to me. Her face is beatific, flushed, candy in the corners of her mouth. Her hands escape her body and fly around her head, my head. I try to capture them while she floats on the dream she remembers. She pulls away when I circle my left arm around her waist. She talks faster as I nuzzle my bristly chin against her cheek. The words spill water bright in full round pieces of sound. The hands still climb in fragments of circles, and she is done. Her story is over. She smiles at me, knowing I have listened, and she turns to the refrigerator, leaving me like some blasted oak about which were once, long ago, seen small birds wheeling in a rush of sound.
Do you have other children besides Becky?
Yeah, 2 boys who are working. Tim is 20 and Jim is 18. And they couldn't come up.
Can you read Uncle Joe?
Yes, if the throat doesn't go, I sure will. I'm beginning to croak.
How do you pronounce it?
Bachi Piak. That's Bohemian for Uncle Drunkard. In southeastern Nebraska, almost everybody is Bohemian. I was the only Irishman in the place. I may be the only Irishman in Missouri Synod for all I know. And I'm sure there must be others. A friend of mine, Bill, this collagist, the artist I was telling you about, he said, "Let's go to Dwight for 4th of July," speaking of 4th of July. I said, "What do they have at Dwight?" He said, "Well, they make buffalo burgers, and they have a big band, Polish band, and all kinds of stuff. Now, that was far better than looking at the wrecks. I said, let's go. So we got in my old Ford station wagon, and we set out to find Dwight. And he'd lived there all his life, but I've never seen it yet to fail, that people never know what anything is in their own town. He said, I think this is the bridge. I said, what do you mean you think this is the bridge? We came to a bridge, and there had been a big flood, and the bridge was disappeared into the water. I said, Bill, we can't cross. He said, sure we can. I said, no, we can't. He said, well, I'll get out on the hood and let you know how safe it is. So there we were. I was going as slowly as I could, and he's on the hood like a big ornament, peering off into the water like George Washington. And we were creeping across, and the water was up to the door. And I said, Bill, he said, sure, you'll make it. I said, easy for you to say. It's my car. And we finally made it. And we got across and came sloshing out, and he got back in the car, and we pulled up, and he said, this doesn't look like white. And it was nobody there. It was a ghost town. It was practically a ghost town. I didn't see anybody. And it was pulled up to the main street, and it was a sign that said bank, with some birds nesting in the corner of the sign and the K falling off. I said, well, let's go in. I got to cash a check anyway because I don't have any money to do anything to buy buffalo burgers. So we went in and opened the door, and the door fell off in my hand. And there was no bank there. The bank had long since been turned into a laundromat. But that was dead, too, and they were open with straw in them and birds hopping about and lizards on the floor. And nobody was there. It was like out of a Rod Serling thing. And we up and down the street, we didn't see him. He said, this is not Dwight. Well, we never did find Dwight. We spent the whole day, Lisa, I don't know where Dwight is. We finally went back across the river. But what we were going for was a Polish wedding. Because he knew there was going to be a big one. Names like Blazak Kula and Frank Solicki and Isabel Glutz or whatever were going to get married. And he was telling me about the Polish wedding. Well, I was disappointed I didn't see it. And I thought about it all night. And then the next day I wrote the poem, Baci Pia. I don't usually tell that story but I just felt like I would, because what I didn't see, none of this, but I thought I'd just tell you to be honest for a change. All right, Baci Pia. The slicked aisle narrowed with a pounding of the dance. The troop banged through the screen door and hit the bar with flat red palms. Uncles, friends, some criers, some laughing slappers boomed down the dancing aisle floor like a tide. The couple watched in wonder, then smiled as the bride appeared in the doorway. An accordion punched out some chords, then squeaked through a hot Polish dance. Mr. and Mrs. behind the bar grinned in mute appreciation and sent foaming glasses spinning and swirling, twirling down the polished bar. Like a great shy queen, the bride against the corner of the room clapped and smiled at the swaying and stomping, then grimaced as the slight blonde girl screamed and threw her arms tightly around the groom, who swung her in a wide arc off the ground and half dragged her down the thin corridor of dusty tavern floor to the arched hands that clapped them through the sweating tunnel. And springing outward from the dark, the uncle landed, knees bent, arms akimbo. Silence in the room. Then slowly from the corner comes the accordion, punching minor chords in a heartbeat cry that dancers, drinkers took up with hot hands as uncle straightened, grinning. Right foot, left foot comes the stamp, stamp of his feet while keeping his legs very straight and close together. The quiet couple sit with gripped hands on the tabletop holding breaths. Sudden then, the dance. Uncle spins and flails his arms, his striped double-breasted suit flaring from his thin sides, fanning the dust from the stamping scuffed shoes that kick upwards, front and backwards, whirling faster, stomping harder. Uncle cries through clenched teeth a terrible whine that sets the watchers worrying, moving to and fro with a steady rhythm from the accordion. Dark lines with sweat stand out on Uncle's head. Eyes, tired and red, are closed in some great oblation to the spirit of the dance that robs the wedding feast of its frolic. The bridegroom moves from the thin blonde and watches his bride sway against the wall. Uncle bends deeply, bending his knees with hands on hips, swaying straight again, his feet banging the floor in golden motts of tangled fire, and down the expectant night crashed the thunder. Then the uncle stops in step, eyes open wide, red faces stare from seething coasts and black collieries of memory. So even though I didn't get there, I got there mentally, imagination. What time do you have? I'm not sure I'll go.
22.
22? Maybe I have time for one short one. Nebraska, that part of Nebraska, southeastern Nebraska, is known as the Bohemian Alps. It's all up and down. Most of Nebraska is pretty flat, but that's the Bohemian Alps. And some very strange things go on there. Those of you who saw Deliverance, or read the book Deliverance, you know, and some pretty spooky things can go on back in the woods in Georgia and Louisiana. I've got some poems. I'm going to read poems from this book Saturday, Voyages, when we went around the country in 76, and some strange things down in Louisiana. We were driving back on these little backwoods hills in Nebraska, though, and I came to a mailbox named Jay Kunasek. And there was old Jay Kunasek out there working on an old Hudson. It was up on blocks, no wheels, and he was diving down into the bowel of this thing, throwing out wires and belts and things. And I really kind of pulled into his drive to turn around, because I was lost anyway, and I thought I'd turn. As soon as I pulled in his driveway, he popped up out of that hood and ran over to me and grabbed my left arm. He says, "You think they'll come back?" My wife said, "Let's get out of here." And the kids were in the car and the dogs. My dog made a lunge for his arm, and I was trying to grab the dog. My wife said, "Get out of here, back of the car." And she says, "You think they'll come back? They dropped him close last night." I said, "Did they?" I said, how close did they come?" She said, "Get the hell out of here." And the dog was snarling on the glass, and the kids were crying in the back because he had these beady eyes. He grabbed my arm. He says, "They were really close, and they were going to bomb me next." He says, "Look over there." I looked over there, and sure enough, there was a crater near his house. And my eyes got blue, and the Lord says, "Get out of here." So I put that thing in reverse, and I started backing up, and he was walking. He says, "If they come again, I'll be ready for them." And I says, "Goodbye, Mr. Kunasek." And he stopped, he looked at my leg, he says, "California, you from California?" I said, "Yes." He says, "I'd purely like to go out there." And he waves, "Hope they don't come back." And away we went. And the last thing I remember is looking out the rearview mirror at this crater near the house, about a 5-foot deep crater. I swear, it all blackened, and he dived back into his Hudson. I told some friends about that later in Seward. They didn't believe me. They said, I told some farmers, they said, "There's no such person as Kunasek out there." I said, "Yes, there is." I asked my dog, my kids, my wife. I had to defend my story. But it was weird. It was one of those kind of brigadoon things, you know. They're not really there at all. Okay, let me read. I'm going to close because my throat's had it. And I got to read for the kitchen crew tonight at 10 o'clock anyway, so I better save a little. This is called Obad for Winter. And Obad is just a fancy French word for this morning song. The winter grass is dry beneath the snow as sparrows hop on wires or scratch the frozen pond. The marrow bone is cold. The winter numbness holds the water blue beneath the ice, while footprints from the autumn past fill up with slush and freeze in place, as if giants walked that way. And still the ground held its breath, not letting go. So cold it is, my soul, I hear no voices in my head that bring me peace. I feel no blood run warmer in my chest or arms. And only when I pass my mirror do I see my face, as if a mask lived there and not a face at all. Christ of the winters, come. Come thaw me out. Let my life rush over bounds. Wet my deep roots. Show me your fiery eyes and catch my soul aflame, for I am cold, and life's the coldest dance, stopped, feet held in place. While all around the kaleidoscope throws colors on the snow, and I'm alone. O Christ, become my Christ. Overpower this dull and lifeless will, overthrow this polished mind, and bring warm rains. Consume me now. Christ, bring your love again. Be thou my spring.